This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Mavis Gragg never thought her work would take her to the trees, but that is where she's found herself. She grew up during the 80s in Western North Carolina as the middle child to a long-haul truck driver and a bank teller. And she spent much of her adult life working as a lawyer, with the mountains and the woods relegated to her past. But last year, she took a position with the American Forest Foundation. She's the director of the Sustainable Forestry and African American Land Retention Program and works to help Black families protect intergenerational wealth. Mavis Gragg joins me now. Mavis, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anita.
So you grew up in Black Mountain, North Carolina in the late 70s and early 80s. Take us to your hometown in that time. What was Black Mountain like at that point?
Yeah, growing up in Black Mountain during the 70s, 80s, early 90s, it definitely felt isolated from the rest of the world. It's a small town. My school is very small. My high school graduating class was just a little over 270 people. So very small, close-knit community, but also in a large sense, very isolated. Especially for someone who was curious about the world beyond the mountains.
So your dad was a long-haul truck driver and your mom was a bank teller. Tell me a bit about your family and what your family life was like as a young kid.
Yeah. So both my parents are from the Valley, the Swannanoa River Valley. My mom grew up in Swannanoa. She grew up in with her mother and her maternal grandparents. Very, very poor conditions from a socioeconomic standpoint, but lots of love. Also very sheltered in the sense that her mom and grandparents didn't let her do a lot of things like ride a bicycle, swim, which definitely had an impact on how she raised my siblings and me. My dad grew up in Black Mountain, and he was raised by his great aunt, Aunt May, as we called her, who also raised other people's children, including my uncle, or technically cousin, Phil. And for a long time, my dad thought that he didn't have a future, given where he lived and just what options were available for African Americans. So he joined the military. That was a very disappointing experience for him. And when he came back, he became he worked at a factory, but then became a truck driver. And trucking for him meant that he could leave the mountains. He could hopefully make some good pay. But it was a big step for him, and I would say for our immediate family, because his seeing the country as a truck driver parlayed back to our family traveling a lot.
Were there many other Black families in Black Mountain?
Well, I guess it's subjective, but I would say no.
Yeah.
people believe that. I will say once I did go to college, I was surprised that people did not know that there were Black people in the Appalachian Mountains, because there were always Black people in the Appalachian Mountains when I was growing up there. Not a lot of us, but we existed. But no, certainly not a lot.
And did that, your parents were both pretty strict, and you mentioned that your mom's mom had also been pretty strict with her. How did that shape your childhood?
Well, I'm a middle child, so I definitely feel like they were more strict on me. But my parents really wanted to make sure that we could achieve what they viewed as success, that we would be able to go to college. That was the ultimate goal for our parents, is that we would go to college. And for that, for me, that meant making really good grades, not getting pregnant, having a lot of structure in your life and sticking to it. So, you know, my dad wanted me, he promised me a Corvette if I graduated law school. Well, everything that I did from a young age had to be directed towards going to law school or getting that degree. And I think that had to do with the fact that my parents just wanted us to have better circumstances than they had socioeconomically and from a racial perspective, because I never met any Black attorneys because there weren't any in Black Mountain. There were black attorneys in Asheville, but Asheville even seemed like a good distance from us as a kid. But I didn't meet my first black female attorney until I went to college.
Well, you realized as a young kid that you wanted to go to law school, and your dad promised, as you said, not just any Corvette, an orange Corvette. How did you land on that being the magical prize? I love that as a 6-year-old. That's hilarious.
Yeah, so daddy would be gone most of the week, but when he came home, it was my goal to spend time with him, particularly one-on-one time. And one thing that we would go do, which was very simple, was just go for a ride. So we would get in his pickup truck, and no judgment to my dad, I would stand next to him with my arm on his shoulders, and we would just go riding around. And I remember we were in Otine, which is this area between Asheville and Swannanoa, and I saw that car, and he promised he would get that for me if I graduated from law school. And I wanted to do anything to please him, so I was like, yeah. I didn't know what law school was, but he gave me a goal, so I went after it. But I did not get the Corvette. I got a Honda.
Oh, not quite the same, but sturdy,
very practical.
Sturdy and long lasting. Well, you mentioned
yes.
that your dad had a really difficult experience when he was in the military, and you've come to mm-hmm. learn a lot more about that in recent years. Mm-hmm. You found a lot of his writings, and I would love for you to share a bit more about his experience and then maybe also a bit of one of the essays that you have come across that he wrote about mm-hmm. his time in the military.
Yeah. My dad would not speak to us very much about his experience in the military. We have very few stories that he shared with us because I think it was so painful, just from a human perspective, but then also from a racial perspective. My dad had advanced in rank and was still treated with a lot of disrespect. So the few stories he shared, you know, made me feel bad for him that he had that experience. But it was so bad that when he returned home, he threw away his Purple Hearts, which may seem disrespectful, but it was because of how he had been treated in the military. But yeah, after my parents passed away and I was going through their papers and so forth, I found these essays that my dad wrote. We don't have complete essays, but there are a few that just give me enough to really appreciate what he was thinking. And it's interesting to think about it now, given what's going on in our world and consider how much has changed. But the one I'll read for you is called Two, just simply T-O, Two. To want to live in what seems to be the best years of your life, to want to be with your loved ones on those few family days, to know that you are a man and always be told to act like a man, but being punished for showing initiative. To be told that to be a better man, you model after him because of different skin color. To always be told what to do and hardly ever asked your opinion. To forget the pride of your color, your culture, and mostly your people because you set yourself as something you are not. And never will be. To have a man of your color and supposedly a brother of black people to be used as an example, but knowing that this black man doesn't know that the white man is only making a fool of him. To be punished for crimes that a white man is rarely ever punished for. To be a man in the armed forces of America and fighting for the dream of being a free man in a country of equality and freedom for all men except a black man.
That's Mavis Gregg reading from an essay her father wrote about his experience as a black man in the American military during the 1960s and 70s. And wow, especially those last three paragraphs, you can imagine someone writing a very similar account today. And I mean, I'm curious, we're going to take a break in just a second, but before we do, I mean, I'd love to know how that essay resonates for you in this very particular moment.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, both pandemics with COVID and then the racial issues and police brutality issues, it's definitely made me yearn for that comfort of parental guidance. You know, I wish I could call my parents and just hear what they think we should do and how we should respond. And so I don't have that, but I do have these essays to go back to. And it gives me an idea that These are some things that Daddy would say, and that he would be able to could guide me based on what he did before.
I'm talking with Mavis Gragg. She's the director of the Sustainable Forestry and African American Land Retention Program at the American Forest Foundation. And we will continue our conversation with her just ahead, learning more about her family life and her own journey into law and how she is helping Black families navigate heirs' property today. You are listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. My guest today is Mavis Gragg. She grew up in Black Mountain, North Carolina, and when she was just a kid, her dad promised her an orange Corvette if she went to law school. That promise motivated her through childhood and into college. She didn't get a hot rod, but with her law degree, Mavis worked to help families navigate the complexities of heirs' property law. And Mavis is still with me now. So we were talking about your dad and his activism and what you really came to learn about that later on in your life. But you had a thread of activism yourself and were involved in high school. I guess maybe your first protest was when you were in high school, in response to what happened to police monitoring the movie theater. Can you tell me that story?
So for us, when we were teenagers, going to the mall and the movies on Saturday was very, very important.
It is the thing. You have to do
It's the
it.
thing. But particularly, for Black kids in Black Mountain, to go to Asheville on the weekend to go to the mall and go to the movies meant we got to see other Black. So it was particularly cherished for my friends and myself. And I can't remember which movie it was. It was either Malcolm X, Autobiography of Malcolm X, or Black Panther, but it was a very Black movie. And the local cinema, which is, I think, now gone, but had been there for many decades, the local cinema changed the rules for people going to see that movie, which, of course, it was mostly Black kids. Going to see the movie on Saturday night, and it got really heated. The police were there and the news was there, but it felt really good to stand up for something we believed in instead of just, figuring something else to do with our time and our money.
How did they change the
But it was
rules?
also there were I can't I mean this is a long time ago. This is literally last century, but I
Yeah.
remember them changing the rules that placed restrictions in a way that we couldn't enjoy the movie with our friends and with the other people who were attending it. Like they placed limitations on the number of people. It was restrictions that made it that pretty much took away from the enjoyment of being able to go see a movie about Black people, made by Black people with other Black people.
Wow. So you
Which
eventually.
in, an area where you don't have that many Black people, that kind of time is needed, so.
Exactly. I mean, how was it then when you transitioned? You went to UNC for undergrad. What was that transition like, leaving Black Mountain for the first time?
Heaven. Oh, I loved it. It was great because, again, growing up, it was just, I always felt different. Part of it had to do with being Black, but also with being someone who is pursuing a college degree. A lot of my peers growing up, they went to work. That was the reality for a lot of people in Black Mountain. You graduate from high school and you go to work. So it was good to be around people who were pursuing a college degree, but also to be around so many people of color, particularly Black people. So UNC at the time maybe had around 2,000 people between the undergraduate and graduate programs who were Black. And then there are also people from other cultural groups. So I was very excited to be with people who looked like me, who also were academically motivated like me. It was exciting. Definitely had a culture shock though, in that a lot of people did not know that I was Black, which was shocking to me because in the mountains, at least what my mom said is we play by the one drop rule. And both of my parents are black. Like, I've always identified as black. So going to Carolina and being asked what's my race was very shocking to me. But other than that, it was a very great
How
experience.
did that affect your own perception of your identity? That must have been really, really disorienting.
Was definitely disorienting, because some black people questioned my race, not negatively, just not negatively, but just very curious about my race, and also non-black people. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that people don't know that there are people of color in the mountains, in the Appalachian Mountains. So that was the first time that I learned that, but it stuck with me so much so that years later, when I became custodian of my family's photos and papers, that I took advantage of the opportunity to donate them to UNC Archives so people could have access to that kind of information. So hopefully researchers and scholars will use that to educate people about the presence of black people in the Appalachians. I mean, slavery was very far and wide in the South. The mountains were not excepted from that.
Well, I want to get to
So.
that because you went to UNC, you attended Pepperdine Law, and then soon after that, you lost both of your parents really tragically and unexpectedly in 2012. Will you tell me more about what happened?
As I mentioned before, my dad was raised by his Aunt May, who also raised Uncle Phil. Uncle Phil, as an adult, moved to Connecticut, but he and his wife and my parents would stay connected and travel together sometimes. So in 2012, they did a trip out west, went to Vegas, and then went to California. And on their way back, unfortunately, were killed in a car accident in Texas. And I was actually in California at the same time they were, but I was in Northern California, so we didn't get to link up. But it was very devastating to lose both parents and then two other family members. And then it was just, I mean, navigating, the irony of being an attorney who has worked in estate administration, but having to do that for your own parents was extremely difficult. So I don't recommend that to anyone. If you are an attorney, you don't have to do that. But it was a very profound moment in my life and in my siblings' lives. A lot of things changed for us very quickly. We were forced to sell our childhood home, to sell our granny's home, which was next door. So two very special places to us. And honestly, I didn't want to practice law anymore. I thought, oh, okay, the people who I'm trying to please and, demonstrate my abilities to are gone. So I don't have to practice law anymore. I've been pursuing this since I was very young, and I just don't want to do it. Which is a hard thing to do when you need to have a job and
Well,
pay your
yeah, I
bills
mean,
and
you're in
so
a
forth.
moment of personal turmoil and emotional distress. So did you, what did you do? Did you quit your law job?
I started working with a coach. So they died in 2012, and in the fall of 2012, I started working with the coach who specializes with lawyers and career strategies. And a year later, my sister and I were in Brazil. We decided to make Christmas our time to travel together, and we were in Brazil, and it was time to come home, and I just started crying, and I was like, I don't want to go. I don't want to work anymore. So then I just kind of shifted gears and figured out how not to work, which took about 6 months, and then I quit. I took a sabbatical for a year and a half, and I think it saved my life.
What did you learn during that time about yourself?
I learned a lot about resiliency. And the importance of building your resiliency. I really think that I needed that time to rest and then also to spend time with people. So I structured my travel during my sabbatical around visits with different people who are important in my life. I also learned that I could be more open with what I choose to do, and I should be because, things aren't guaranteed. So there's no reason for me to just stick on a very straightforward path like I had always done. It's important for me to pursue things based on what I value the most. And that sounds very easy, but it took a lot of work, just resting, doing a lot of deep thinking, but I needed that time to be able to do that. And that's how I came to the place where I decided to open my law practice and practice law the way that I want to practice law.
And what did that mean? What did practicing law the way that you wanted to look like? How did you shift?
It meant that I would work on the issues that I care most about, and I would use my skills to do my skills and experience to help those people I care most about, and that I would still get paid for it. A lot of lawyers pursue passion-driven work, but don't get paid well for it. So it was important to me to try to always maintain that part too, getting compensated for it. And so, I chose to work on death and dirt. I chose to work with families who are land rich, cash poor. I chose to work on issues that a lot of lawyers don't want to work on because of the complexity of it and the lack of sometimes lack of satisfaction from the clients because it is so complex. But I wanted to craft it in a way that made it sustainable for me and make it possibly sustainable for other attorneys to do that work.
So that meant that you worked a lot on heirs' property, and I'd love for you to explain what that is and the complexities of heirs' property. I mean, you obviously came to see it yourself after your parents died, but give us a bit of an overview of what it is.
And I'm glad that you pointed that out. I also own heirs' property. So many people own heirs' property. Heirs' property really refers to any type of real estate that's owned by multiple people, each of whom have inherited their share. I think people have heard more and more about heirs' property in the last couple of years because of the tremendous land loss that has been experienced by the Black community. But it's an issue that impacts many Americans because most families that have land will transfer it by this method, by inheritance. And so heirs' property is an issue that affects people across the country. I have focused specifically on the African American community and families who are land rich, cash poor, because they need the help the most.
And what is it? I mean, it's, I think when you look at the statistics of, 12 million acres of land lost in the past 100 years by Black Americans, I mean, it's so shocking and hard to understand how that could come to be. And I know it is a wide variety of factors, but tell me about the unique challenges of heirs' property and how it can lead to this kind of land loss.
So for I think for communities for families who have this who own their land in this way, the way the law is set up for joint ownership is applicable to everyone, including people who aren't families, who joint owners who aren't families. So there's no special application of the law for families unless your state has adopted this. So in addition to that, if you also have are from a community that has been historically discriminated against and currently discriminated against, if using the legal system has posed a threat on your life, then it makes it even more damning and it contributes to additional loss. And then if you think about the land that the African Americans, just using African Americans as an example, if you think about the land that we were able to acquire, we often did not have the best picks of the land. We often were only able to get land in the areas that were undesirable at the time. So the potential to grow your wealth through your land was often capped, and so that it added to the devastation of the land loss. But and if you a lot of times when we think about African American land loss, we point to the coast of South Carolina and Georgia, the Gullah Islands. In particular, a lot of that land was owned by African Americans who were recently freed and then became of interest to developers for second homes, for vacation, for resorts, and so forth. And they were able to use the legal structure and the legal system to take land legally, but had very devastating impact on the land ownership for African Americans along the coast. But it happens all over. In present times, the Appalachian Mountains is an area of risk because there are a lot of families, many of whom or most of whom are not Black, but they own their land as heirs' property. And as the market demands for this kind of land in the Appalachian Mountains increases, there's a real threat to these families, but also to our vistas.
Yeah.
The mountains could necessarily change in a significant way if these families don't have the kind of legal resources and laws that support them in keeping it.
So, as a lawyer, what were the practical steps that you took to help people who you describe as land rich but cash poor? What could you do to help them protect intergenerational land transfer?
I'll say first, having some clear understandings of what my values are were very important to me, because it's easy for lawyers to just see themselves as problem solvers, but in the case of heirs property, we really have to be counselors, and you really have to tap into your client's ethical and moral and spiritual and emotional values, in addition to what's going on from a legal perspective. And I think that's really important, because if you just go in it with a mindset of, oh, my job is to solve the problem, you could actually miss opportunities to help them in a meaningful way, because it's not easy work. And I think also just having the flexibility to some creativity with your pay structure. I believe that families should not lose thousands of dollars pursuing a resolution of an heir's property matter. I think that the lawyers and the family should take a very creative, flexible approach to ensure that you can make progress, but it's not usurping all of their money. And so the way I worked with clients is that I required that they had a family tree before they start working with me, because if they don't have a family tree, then they're going to pay me to do a family tree, and they shouldn't. But a lot of lawyers who do this won't, they don't do that for the clients, and I think that's important.
Is some of this also just encouraging people to have wills? I mean, did your parents not have a will, and is that what part of what caused the challenges for you all?
Yeah, so my parents are a model example. Most Americans do not have wills, and my experience with my work in law is that people who have wills and have land that they pass on to the next generation most often create the same kind of issues, because they leave their land to multiple owners. So having a will isn't necessarily the issue. It's having being counseled by an attorney to create a plan that works for your specific circumstances, and that could include putting ownership of the land while you're alive, putting it into a different entity, such as a trust or LLC, and manage the intergenerational succession from that perspective. A will is not the answer. I
And well, I
forgot the
mean,
rest of your question, but.
yeah, no, that makes total sense. And I guess a lot of it, as you mentioned, has to do with understanding the value beyond just the land. Like, what is the cultural significance of this property? What is the family's relationship to this property? And for you, I mean, how did you approach that part of the conversation?
I think so. I also have a master's degree in dispute resolution, and my first job after law school was in mediation. And I think those active listening skills are very important. I think it's really important to spend time with the family and just hear the story. So the intake process is a bit different from what you would do for a speeding ticket or divorce. It really is learning the story of the family's land and finding out why it's important to them, and if things were ideal, what would that look like? And extracting the information you need from a legal perspective through that kind of conversation. Because it is so painful. I mean, I have heirs property with my siblings, and we get along, thankfully. Love you, Harold and Monica. But it's hard. This land that we were given a responsibility that we weren't prepared for at a time that was very devastating for us. And so even the three of us have a hard time, taking action with the land. So I think empathy is another aspect of it, is having empathy for the families and really helping them get the story out as a way of addressing some of the emotion behind it, because it is very emotional. But I think it's also helpful in terms of getting information that you wouldn't get if you were just being very strict and asking very formalized questions.
Yeah. Mavis Gragg is the director of the Sustainable Forestry and African American Land Retention Program at the American Forest Foundation. And as we continue our conversation, we will hear more about that job and her transition into this work. As we continue our conversation with Mavis Gragg on the state of things, please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. I'm here with Mavis Gragg, Director of the Sustainable Forestry and African American Land Retention Program at the American Forest Foundation. Nearly a year into the position, Mavis has adapted her knowledge of intergenerational land transfer to fit the needs of Black families who own private forests. Black land ownership has plummeted in the past century, but Mavis and her team are working to remedy the losses by helping families maintain their land. So we were talking about your experience starting your own law firm and kind of acknowledging your own personal history with inheritance and ownership. And before we move to your new job, I just want to touch on one other thing that you all inherited after your parents passed, which was a trunk filled with quilts. And that has been an adventure for you to learn about them and to think about how to best preserve them. So tell me more about that.
Yeah. So my mom's mom, Granny Frances, had this big trunk in her house that we were never allowed to go into. I thought maybe there was a body or something, but I mean, she told us it was great granny's quilt, her mom, but I didn't believe her because she never let us in it. She never let me in it. But so I became custodian of that and finally opened it. And it has mostly quilts, quilt tops. So great granny would quilt. She'd make quilts, and I'm not sure why she never finished these quilts, but I thought it was really special that we have them, but also know that it's important that they be placed somewhere where they can be useful for educational purposes and just taken care of. I don't know about handling quilts, and I know you're supposed to fold them and so forth, so yeah, I reached out to my friend Michelle Lanier, and who's a folklorist, and I said, you know, what should I do? Who should I contact? And one of the things that she advised me on was to document my relationship with those quilts. And so I brought in my friend, who's a photographer, Dare, and we took portraits of me with my great granny's quilts, which was really, really special. And actually became useful for my website, my LinkedIn page.
So. Oh, there you go. Very colorful background to make everything pop. Well, I mean, as you have gone through this, I mean, so many stages of your career already, what made you decide to take this latest job with the American Forest Federation and the Gragg Law Firm for now?
Yeah. So thankfully the practice was successful. I was able to, cause when you're an entrepreneur, you have to kill what you eat. So I felt very fortunate that it was successful and that I was able to survive personally. I was in a crossroads, about a year ago, thinking about whether to scale up my practice or recast how I do the work, because it is very intense emotionally. And I wanted to make sure that I could continue to thrive in doing this work. So the job came open around the time that I was already trying to figure out what I would do with my practice so that I could continue doing it in a meaningful way. And initially I thought, oh, I know someone who's good for this job. And a couple of days later realized I was thinking of myself. I had wanted to have a bigger impact on the state of Ayers property, you know, in terms of policy and innovation. But being a solo practitioner, I really was limited to what I was able to build. So this felt like a good fit for me because I was able to work with other people who are doing the same type of work and have the same kind of passion and commitment to helping families save their land. So it's been a blessing to take on this job, but I never imagined that I would work in a conservation organization, yet alone a forestry organization.
Well, yeah. I mean, how does forest land play into the conversation about Black land loss? I feel like I've heard mostly reporting on farmland. So tell me about the forest land piece of it.
Yeah. I had never considered Black owned forest before. I hadn't really considered forest really before this project. And if you think about it, if you have land that has trees, then you might likely have a forest. So a lot of people with farms even have a substantial amount of trees on their farm. And forestry purposes, they qualify as a forest. And then another thing that most people don't know is that most of the forests in the United States are actually privately owned, and owned by families. And so our country's health, our state's health, our community's health is really supported by privately owned forests. So it is important to work with forest owners. And within the context of the Black community, a gentleman who worked at the U.S. Endowment for Forestry and Communities, by the name of Alan McGregor, thought about this significant land loss in the African American community and the fact that many African Americans, even before we were able to own land, were working in agriculture, were working with lands and have lands that they are trying to take care of, came up with the idea of partnering for, or not pairing, sorry, pairing forestry with land retention. Can we work with landowners, African American landowners who have trees to become good stewards of their forest, learn good forestry practices, but also help them address the retention issues, making sure that they can remove the barriers to keeping their family's forest for multiple generations. And so they piloted the project in three states, including North Carolina, and it was a success. And now we're in eight states,
Wow.
which is exciting.
Well, you mentioned, the emotional toll of the work that you were doing. And while this may be with an organization and slightly more removed from direct family stories, there is obviously that strong personal connection between what you and your family have gone through, the statistics that you know, your own relationship with your own family's inheritance. It's a huge question, but how do you manage all of that in the context of still having to show up every day and do your job? That feels like a heavy load.
That's a big question, especially given the circumstances of the last few weeks. It's hard because people, when a conservation organization talks about its role in racial inequity and land loss, it's a difficult conversation because a lot of people who are conservationists or environmentalists who care about those issues do not see a direct relationship between police brutality and just general brutality of a specific community. And it's a difficult conversation, but I think that the current events are forcing organizations, including my own, to think about what role we play in addressing those injustices and what good work can we do to eliminate them.
Do you
So
think?
it's a challenging time for me personally as an African American because it's like overall it's depressing to hear this to see what's going on when you have to show up for work and then try to be creative and innovative and it's not something you learn in school.
Do you feel like people are making the connection between property ownership and the racial wealth gap and other conversations going on about systemic injustice, or do you think that the
Yes.
threads, you do feel like it's coming together?
I think it is. I mean, I've been fortunate to be related to organizations where I think it is. So, including American Forest Foundation, but also Triangle Land Conservancy, which is a land trust that I'm the board chair for here in Durham. I see it, and it's very affirming. It's still difficult, but it's very affirming. I feel hopeful.
Well, in addition to all of your legal work, you have many, many a hobby. And I would love
I
to
get my
know
curiosity from my parents too.
you, seriously, you have so much going on. And a big part of it is art, which we haven't really spoken a ton about. You're called the chief artsy friend by some of your friends. I'd love to know about how your love of art developed alongside all of your other passions.
Honestly, it was something different and completely unrelated to my reality at the time, which was having lost my parents. So I had actually, when I was in DC, I was in DC when my parents passed away and had returned to work. And the Corcoran Gallery of Art, which is now closed, they have a docent program. And I applied because one of my coworkers, who was an attorney here, so I said, oh, well, I'll do this as extracurricular activity. But then I learned after my parents passed that I was accepted into the program. And it was just it was an escape for me. It was something totally counterintuitive for me. My parents didn't let me take art classes in middle school and high, or not middle school, but in high school, because that you don't need to go to art class to go to law school. So to me, it was a bit of a rebellion. And I did the docent program, which was really like going back to school, learned a lot, and thought, wow, this man had a private collection that he then opened up to the world. What can I do like that? I mean, I'm not a wealthy banker like he was, but I thought about the fact that I could be a custodian of art, and I could be a custodian of art that I really care about, an artist that I really care about, which for me was mainly female artists and artists from the African diaspora. So my big purchase, my first big purchase, I actually used from I purchased with proceeds from my parents' accident. And it's this piece by Maya Freelon called Patience. And I see it every day when I wake up.
What drew you to that piece? Tell me about it.
Just her process and the fact that she was connecting to her ancestors in creating her work, and the delicacy of life that I think is shown through her work. It was a lot of money to spend on tissue paper, but I really connected with it and connected with her. We're actually friends now. But that sparked a bug in me, and I started collecting more work. And most of the work is from female artists and from the African diaspora, but lots of color, and lots of strength represented in the pieces. But that collecting the art made me realize that I can take a role, I can play a role in connecting others with art, but also in preserving stories. Yeah, I think art tells stories, and I love it. So now I host events where the goal is to get people to collect, and also just to help artists not be as shy. Artists are often very shy about selling their work. So the idea with the talk series that I have is that artists and collectors can feel comfortable being together and talking to each other. So it's kind of like being a mediator. There's no conflict, but I'm just facilitating
But I think that's
the
so important
discussion.
because I feel like in conversations around art curation and art buying, I think there is this assumption that it's going to be super expensive. And while, it's important to value art for its worth, you encourage conversations about, oh, can we start a payment plan? Is there a way that I can, support the value of your work, but maybe not cash out all of that right now? So you have so much going on right now. You're a year into a new job. You have all of these artistic ideas. What do you see as kind of the next few years for Mavis Gragg? What's on the horizon?
So my I have a few things and on the stove or whatever the analogy is, but my sister and I founded Black Women Drone. So we're building that community. It's meant to be a community for Black women who drone, for education and connecting and so forth. And then as a way of celebrating my law practice, now that I've closed it, I have been working on an app for heirs property owners, which I'm really excited about because, again, I never thought that I would be doing something like this. But taking these risks have given me an open heart and willingness to try new things. So hopefully in the next few years we'll see that really impacting people. And yeah, maybe a vacation. Do we
Yeah, I
get
was about to say, okay,
vacations?
so you told me about Black Woman Drone. You're doing an app. Are you going to rest at all?
I go to bed early.
Well, what does, I mean, I'd love to end on that note about just kind of, your own connecting with yourself in this moment and what practices you engage in to do that and to really kind of center or step away when there is just so much going on.
I've been I have a mindfulness practice, so it is practicing, which takes a long time to learn. But yeah, I love hiking now. I didn't hike before, but I love hiking, and I like to take my friends on hikes. It's one of the ways I like to spend time with my friends. Swimming, which I hope I get to do sometime this year. Love swimming. So connecting with nature and connecting with friends, quality time is my love language. And that's what really feeds me and restores me.
And you and your sister, you mentioned that you all have Black Women Drone going on together. You two are really close, I'm guessing.
Yes.
So
Very
connecting with
close.
her on more projects coming down the pipeline, perhaps.
Yeah, I would say my sister, when I give her an idea, even if I'm just saying something out loud, my sister will have a web page and a Slack account set up instantly. So things move pretty quickly when you share ideas with my sister, but she's great. So yeah, and we also we founded the Gregg Family Fund with the Community Foundation of Western North Carolina in honor of our parents, and so we are doing some work on that too. That's been a really, really important way for us to honor our parents, but also just find something joyful out of something very painful. So we will continue working on that and helping kids go abroad. So yeah, definitely more things with Monica.
All right. Well, you can find links to all of the things we talked about today on our website, stateofthings.org. Mavis Gregg is the director of the Sustainable Forestry and African American Land Retention Program at the American Forest Foundation. She's also the co-founder of Black Women Drone and the Gregg Family Fund. Mavis, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Mavis, as I said, stateofthings.org.